Everything is designed to eliminate the friction between our activity and our decision to make that purchasing click. Why can't we have a similar type of experience at work?
Today we're going to be talking about humans at work with the people that wrote the book on it, Anna Tavis and Stella Lupashore, joining us today on the podcast to talk about their book and their finding, Humans at Work, The Art and Practice of Creating the Hybrid Workplace. Anna Tavis is a clinical professor and academic director of the Human Capital Management Department at NYU's School of Professional Studies. She's a senior fellow with the Conference Board and Academic in Residence for the Executive Networks. Stella Lupashore is the founder of Reframe.Work, Inc., she currently consults leaders on workplace experience through the use of human-centered design, technology, people, analytics, and future thinking. She teaches digital workplace design and design thinking at NYU's School of Professional Studies as well, where she is a senior fellow and program director for the conference board. In their book, which I picked up, if you haven't, you're going to want to go out and pick it up after this podcast. We talked about a lot. We talked about human resources and how it's built. We talked about technology and its role in the employee experience. We talked about the gig economy, and so much about their book talks about how we, not just how work was structured, but how we should better structure it for the future. You're not going to want to miss this one. Here's Anna and Stella on Humans at Work. Let's bring it in.
Maybe to start, love to get some quick backgrounds on yourselves, and maybe we can start with you, Anna.
Okay, cool. I am academic director, department chair of human capital management programs. And after a career at Fortune 50 companies and having emerged out of the financial crisis, having worked on Wall Street, I re-entered academia and decided to dedicate myself to growing the next generation HR. And one of the things that frustrated me about our profession was that it wasn't particularly future focused. So what could I do as an educator to kind of help shape that innovative people function going forward? And in my role at NYU, I was able to create what I consider really very forward-looking programs. We have a human capital analytics and technology program focused on using data and technology with responsibility up as it applies to people management and executive coaching organizational consulting. We are the first program in the country that educates with a master's in science degree coaches. We believe that coaching is going to be the future of management in general, not just HR. And clearly we have the foundational program for HR. So at this point in my career, I dedicate myself to research on future of work and then translating it into an educational path for the next generation leaders.
And similarly to Anna, my name is Stella Lupashore. I'm also involved in the academia. I'm an adjunct in the Human Capital Analytics and Technology program that Anna just referred to. In addition to that, I consult on workplace experience through the use of technology and analytics. And similarly to Anna, I come from a large corporate background. I did a lot of technology implementation process and service delivery transformation strategy work for HR. And along the way, there was always an analytics component since I come from a technical and quantitative background. So analytics was also a part of my vocabulary, and I led analytics, people analytics practices at a couple of financial institutions. Thrilled to be here.
Great. Yeah. Humans at Work, the art and practice of creating the hybrid workplace. Anna, why'd you both come together to write the book?
We partnered because we kind of bring complementary skills to this project. My focus was mostly on employee experience from the humanistic perspective. I dove into philosophy and history and kind of tried to, with a broad brushstrokes, paint a picture that what we are experiencing is an evolution of human history from from Plato, literally from the Greeks and the Romans and the Stoics. And then looking at the importance of re-entering that connection with work that I felt we've been losing along the way as technology started to come in. At the same time, I am very aware how practitioners at this point in industrial history approach work. And that's Stella's expertise in technology and her ability to break it down and translate what I was trying to communicate in bigger concepts into specific, practical, deliverable elements and create models and applications. And she can talk about it herself. I felt that was an important juncture for us to join on and produce something that will be valuable both from, the conceptual, big strategic and humanitarian perspective, as well as very practical from the application and day-to-day function of any organization. Stella?
Yeah. So the aspect where the components that I was able to bring to this incredible project and accomplishment is the frameworks and ways to rethink how the workforce, workplace, and worth is changing, and how might we, as HR practitioner, as technology experts, as analytics professionals, can help the organization look at the work that needs to get done in a slightly different way, and as a result, unleash the potential for the workforce or reimagine what the workplace experience might look like, and make it in a way that speaks to the business leaders, makes in a way that does not disrupt the possibilities and the value the company creates. Instead, it creates new sources of talent, it creates more equitable and more inclusive work environment, and uses technology to bring not only transparency, but also efficiency and delight and fun.
I have so many questions, so I hope that's okay. And I'm going to
jump in.
We can fight over them. But one of the things Anna early in the book talk about that was I had never realized the origin, but was the conversation around McKinsey study titled "The War for Talent," and when you really hear it the way you talked about it, you're like, yeah, those are pretty heavy words, and words matter. And when you start using the word talent and then you start calling it a war for, and when McKinsey does it, then everybody follows, given who they are. I guess, can you speak a little bit to the language we use when we talk about workers, especially in human resources and professionals? And I found that really intriguing.
Sam, it's such a good point. My undergraduate degree was in linguistics. I started out as a linguist, so I have I pay particular attention to the use of words and terminology, and obviously it all became brands and how we brand what we do, and that's what gets into the ecosystem, and people are reusing the words, et cetera, and how it starts to affect what we actually do, right? And there's obviously so much interesting research in neuroscience right now, in cognitive science and behavioral science that are coming in into economics and then beginning to influence technology and everything else. In fact, my thesis is that technology as we know it now is just a snapshot, a historical snapshot. It will go on to be reconnecting with the most kind of human qualities of who the humans are. I think we've built a whole generation of business managers on some false assumptions, or maybe false interpretations, because anytime you go back to the text, like, for example, Milton Friedman, you know, who used to be the most venerable economist in the world and Nobel Prize, et cetera, et cetera. And now we're looking back and saying shareholder value, you know, and how powerful those particular concepts have been. And now we are trying to slowly disconnect from that way of thinking. And the same thing with the war for talent. You know, it really was probably the first time, Sam, that we realized the impact of branding what we do with humans and then putting it in circulation. It's almost like a precursor to the social media effects that we're seeing now. And then obviously we code these concepts in a hardwired way into all the tech tools and analytics, because, you know, again, we're worshiping analytics and technology right now, but we're beginning to realize that those are just the artifacts of multiple, you know, ways we do things as humans. So the data are human artifacts. That's what I'm saying. It's just expressed in a different way. So that's where, you know, I kind of took that point in history when McKinsey, the most at that time, the most influential consulting firm in the world, and I actually did work with them on this particular project when I was working for Motorola in my first corporate job, how that kind of became what we understood to be good people management, and how flawed it was. And I think it's very important for us to have that critical mindset because, again, of that power of technology that we currently have, that just hardwires stuff that is actually not very good for us. And so I am delighted to see that now we are moving away from that language. We no longer talk about talent, we talk about people. And you can see even human resource functions being renamed into employee experience functions or people experience functions, and kind of democratizing the whole idea of people management. And that's why I felt that it's very important to bring that point through in the book and not just end up with showing the latest models and the latest data points about what's happening in the current work environment.
Can I add a few comments on the topic of language? Because I think we have designed the world in the work environment that not only technology automates and creates inequities and creates potential for discrimination, but it is shaping how we perceive ourselves and how we behave. So there was a lot of debate that Anna and I had about even the word people or definition of workforce, because we call people employees, employee experience, and increasingly more and more of us go solopreneurs, pursue gig economy, part-time work. All of that excludes those segments from a lot of the programs that we design, from a lot of the opportunities that we offer. So in a way, being an employee, it's already a privilege that comes with a lot more benefits and perks and HR support than the rest of the workforce. So for us, language was an important component that we look at the workforce in a holistic way, since we have workforces of different kinds of, and including digital labor, that's part of the workforce. It gets the work done. So how we work and coexist next to each other matters. The workplace, that's another broader, more inclusive conversation, because it's not just the office space or the working from home. Workspace, it's a lot more expansive than just those physical and digital realms. And it's really describing where the people get the work done. And that can be co-working space, that can be on an island, that can be in your on your device, as long as you have all the equipment and the tools and the access to everything that you need to perform the work done, regardless of the physical space you occupy. So I think when we start unpacking a lot of things that constitute our work environment, we have a lot of opportunity to not only redesign and use technology differently and be more responsible in creating analytics dashboards or whatever solutions, but also how we articulate what the HR does and how we support the activity of getting the work done.
Yeah, Stella, I want to ask you about technology, because again, taking the point that was just made about language, and over the years, coming in and out of different organizations and looking at the way people budget things tells you how they prioritize stuff, right? You know, and you see, we're even seeing it right now in this moment of, are we in a recession? Is it recession coming? And you're seeing where the layoffs are. Amazon just laid off thousands of workers. They fell into two camps, human resources, frontline retail. And it feels like that's obviously a common trend. And I want to ask you about how technology can play a role in, you know, this moment where oftentimes human resources, and it's, you talk to business leaders and they say, you know, that's the first thing that goes. It was in many ways the first thing that went during COVID, which is why so many companies struggled to hire workers back. You know, they let go of the units responsible for coaching, development, identification. So what are the opportunities of technology in a moment where budgets just continuously get cut in this area and the solutions selected may not always be the ones that are best for every worker?
I love this question. And I think a lot of times we look at the technology as a solution to problems. Well, we'll automate, therefore we can cut costs, human costs, or we'll put, robots in place.
We got ChatGPT now.
ChatGPT, exactly. You name whatever it is, as opposed to looking at the technology as an enabler to create more capacity for humans to get their work done. And it's so sad to hear all the layoffs that are impacting HR. And even more dramatic is to hear that companies are laying off their DEI departments and resources. Like, really? It's the first one to go. However, I think when we look through the lens of technology at the opportunities, it's really to create a better workplace experience. It's, if you think about how technology changed our interaction and how we consume products and how we engage with brands, everything is designed to eliminate the friction between our, activity and our decision to make that purchasing click. Why can't we have a similar type of experience at work? A lot of technologies are being built there to automate certain processes and make the process more efficient, but not create a better experience. So we have systems that don't talk to each other. We have data that are not normalized. We have inefficient processes that are enabled by technology that now makes bad processes faster. So if we were to use the human centricity and create that experience for the workers so they can be better at what they do or do the things better and faster, then everybody will benefit. And probably in most cases, companies will get a lot more out of the worker and increase the productivity and not have to lay off anyone. But it requires a very different way of engaging IT departments and digital. It requires a different mentality for HR to advocate on behalf of the workers. And it requires, of course, a different set of justification for why this investment matters. Because if you invest in people, all of that will come back in space for your customers as well as for your bottom line. And I know you have probably...
One of the things I think is very important to keep in mind, in what gives me hope, is a lot of research that's happening in neuroscience and behavioral sciences, et cetera. And even the whole question of frictionless life is thrown into question, right? Like, what kinds of frictions do we really need as humans? I was just looking at some latest research on something like microbiome, the ecosystem of microbes and now intestines, et cetera, et cetera. Very popular health topic these days. And by creating frictionless and cleaning out and creating all the products that are industrially produced and very efficiently produced, you know, we are actually basically exterminating ourselves as a species, because we've been developed to be, you know, to coexist with certain level of challenge. Or after the pandemic, an example, after the pandemic, why do we have this triple epidemic right now? With all of these diseases coming back, it's because we spent 2 years isolated, or China is a good example, zero COVID, and didn't expose ourselves to challenges. So on the one hand, and this is where I think the whole concept of technology, we cannot move forward with technology without understanding the true impact from the, you know, again, neuroscience perspective, the biology perspective, physiology, everything. Those sciences have to be developed along with technology. We gave the whole power of designing workplace or creating our social networks or even running our, you know, governments, et cetera, to technologists, right? Now our CEOs of social networks make political decisions on behalf of the entire world, right? So I think this is, I think we are just coming to the point where we are realizing the limitations of worshiping technology as a god that was going to save us from ourselves. Now, I think we need to turn it around and make it human and say, no, we have to slow down. And the whole decision about what the future of technology, including the workplace, is going to look like, it's going to be a very diverse group of creators that needs to come together to understand the actual impact of what's being designed. Because as we all know from all the conversations we hear, our environment is being affected, and you know, GDP growth is growth, the goal for us. As we are now tossing out shareholder value, at least theoretically, economists all agree on this, is GDP the right measure of flourishment, of human flourishing? And the same thing for the workplace. And I do think that there are very thoughtful leaders. And my example of this will be Satya Nadella from Microsoft, who actually grew up, and look at the pedigree there. He followed Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs right now is the biggest philanthropist in the world. But when he was a CEO, he was the opposite of that, right? He was very much focused on the business, et cetera, et cetera. Then Obama came after him, who was even more, you know, deterministic about how the business needed to be done. Bill Gates, yes. Oh, sorry. Steve Jobs. Bill Gates, right. Bill Gates. And then Satya Nadella comes along with a very different background, turns the company around 180%, basically showing to everyone that it is possible to do in the workplace. It is possible to build accessibility, inclusion, and other types of valuable, you know, assets into technology that Microsoft as a technology company creates. So I'm very passionate about it. And that's where I'm, and I apologize, Steve Jobs actually is a visionary who I really respect very much, as much as Bill Gates. But I think there's an opportunity for us there to be rethinking holistically. And that's how the book came about. And that's what was so helpful for me to have those conversations with Stella, coming from computer background, technology background, and myself with what I bring to the table as a linguist and primarily as a talent leader in organizations.
Yeah, there's a bunch of highlights that I had as I went through that they were very punchy. You know, there's no work without a worker. HR has got to be employee first, not employer first. Work is not working. Concept of being stakeholder first for shareholder first. Let's play like a game here for a second. You know, there's organizations who are out there that are trying to think about how they organize themselves to create the right work environments for their people, which also means that their people are continuously developing. It means they're not churning workers. It means that, you know, maybe the back of house person can someday work in the front of the house, and the front of house person can someday, the American dream that you can start low and move up through the workforce that unfortunately oftentimes doesn't happen. How should, if a CEO is listening, what are your recommendations for how to construct a human, and again, I'll say human resource just for a placeholder because we talked about repositioning it, but for the part of the operation that is responsible for what's traditionally human resources, how would we construct that to be most effective long-term? I'm going to just say one more thing, because it seems like when I look at a lot of organizations and you double click on human resources, and you might go down a path and look at the person in charge of training or learning and development, and they're not always classically trained in the cognitive science area you mentioned that they are responsible for. They're oftentimes the best person who's been, you know, they survived the storms and now they are put into this position that, again, a very important position, talent development, employee training, coaching, but maybe they don't have the coaching themselves to be successful. So the overall question, how should we construct HR knowing that sometimes it feels like the people that are put into those roles maybe aren't yet equipped to be successful?
They should definitely come to NYU to get their HR credentials. That's for sure. You know, the quick answer to that, Sam, is that HR, it has been professionalizing significantly. And if you look at the highest performing organizations, you do see cognitive scientists, computer scientists, data scientists specializing in the workplace, IO psychologists. And not every HR person should be credentialed, but the teams of specialists are being brought in the advisory role. It used to be that organizations outsourced these expertise. They would have a more administrative role on the inside, and then the CEO would be engaging with consultants. That's kind of how it used to be set up. And I think more and more companies realize that they can't outsource their culture. They can't outsource the care of their people. And so being mindful about who their HR, at least HR leaders are, and create that diversity on the team of specialties. There's no longer just an kind of generic HR person. There are lots of specialties. And I would say HR probably is the most diversified function because you get everyone from HRS, people who are looking after technology systems, AI specialists these days, and you will get comp and benefits. You are going to get wellness. You're going to have psychologists who are going to be looking after EAP, employee assistance programs, et cetera. Well-being is now in the HR space, et cetera. So they're hiring nurses and people who really can look after those types of needs, human needs. It's a very diverse function. And I think that a mindful CEO who understands the importance of people for themselves will absolutely staff and design their HR organizations in a very, very different way than just a convenient, assistant, administrative assistant who just been around for a long time and is a nice guy who you can promote to the head of HR. I think those days are, in the majority of cases, are gone. Even in the smaller organizations, people are aware of the importance of that function. But I'm definitely biased. Stella, what is your view?
I completely agree with that. And I think we think of HR more as a risk management function, right? It helps the company protect itself, puts the practices in place, helps things be operational, respect the regulatory requirements, report on to EEOC. So the things that classically were being taught and expected from personnel, I think we're moving into a lot more complex world where we have a variety of worker segments we need to engage with, a variety of technology that enables our work. So the complexity is elevated. And I think we need to think at HR as a sense and response system. How can you understand the health and the flourishing or the environment that creates that flourishing ability for talent or for the people to thrive? And what are the interventions that are necessary? And in order to implement those interventions, obviously you need to have a consultative mindset. You need to have analytical data to make decisions based on that. You need to have really good partnership with IT, with communications, with all the other functions inside the organization to steer them in the right direction to create that workplace experience that the workers expect. So it's a sense and response, and it's more of a integration, kind of a vertical integration that HR can drive to align the other parts of the organizations to support employees.
So I have a feeling you're not going to like this question, but I'm going to ask it. if you could only measure one thing as in an HR operation, because not everybody is large or Fortune 50, if you were a fast-growing retail brand with 30 locations and an HR leader, you could only measure one thing today, what would be the metric that you would implore them to be looking towards?
Am I allowed to have an index? I call it Workforce Vitality Index. And it is looking at the inputs. So how many people are you hiring? How diverse that is, looking at the outputs, how your voluntary attrition and high performer attrition looks like, looking at the internal mobility rate and cost of talent or cost of workforce. And you, these are measurements that every organization has. If you plan for them and you track your progress towards the plan, you'll be really quickly able to identify whether what you're doing works, because they're all self-reinforcing. If you hire too fast and not integrating them, you will see attrition spike or you will see costs going up. If you don't create mobility, people are going to leave again. So all of these measurements work in tandem and gives a very easy and existing solutions for HR to show and tell the leaders how well they're doing as far as the people management.
Yeah. And what I would say, Sam, I will use a metaphor. Stella uses indices and I use the metaphor. I would say it's the employment brand or the talent brand, which includes everything that Stella described. It's a reputation that you have as an employer in the market. So how do other talented professionals, the rare skill set holders, right, view your organization as a potential place of work? It's an external measure, and a lot of it could be subjective. We can break it down to the indices and identify specific elements of that, but I think it comes down to simple. Do talented people want to work for you? Given the choice, will they choose your company over talented people and trust their instincts and trust their research, because they're going to go to, you know, Glassdoor and figure it out, and they will see reviews, and they're going to be a part of the community that has that urban legend, you know, the conversations about different employers, because, and so their assessment of your value as an employer is is I think what would be the most interesting to explore and break down, because a lot of it, some of it is tangible, but a lot of it is not.
I love it. Thank you both. I appreciate the conversation. I have one final question for you both. And we've been talking about humans at work, but you know, a lot of this conversation is, you know, kind of falls into the lane of future of work. And I know that's a phrase that's popularized. I'd like to know what your hopes are for the future of work. And we can start with Stella.
I live through my children, and my hope is that the environment will allow them to accomplish their full potential and realize their dreams. And I realized having three of them and having the spectrum of what that is, what their vision of the future is, I realize it's very complex. And I think that's what the workplace needs to be, to provide whatever people need at that life stage, at the point in their career. Because when you have children or when you have family situations, you may have very different expectations on support and preferences as far as engaging with the work. So how might we create a future where we contribute, stay gainfully employed, remunerated for our talent? At the same time, we have the flexibility we need to have a life as well.
All right. I'm going to finish on a poetic note. My favorite quote about the future of work is from Manish Shafiq. She is the now just recently, literally last week, became the president of Columbia University, a competitor school for us. But she said in the past, the work was about the muscle. In the present, it's about the brain. In the future, it's about the heart. And so my hope for the future of work is that we are finally going to understand the value of intangibles. We've been so focused on what we can measure, what we can cut and paste, but I think what's coming in, and that's where the whole experiential space is opening up widely for us. It's going to be about accommodating the most important and most difficult part of what makes us human, and that is our emotions, our positive emotions, our attractions. And that's what will be leading to that human flourishing that everyone is looking for. Thank you.
Anna, Stella, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
There's no doubt that technology today is fundamentally impacting the worker experience, not just the work experience. And brands, while they invest a ton in how they can make technology more effective, more efficient, more enabled to reach their consumer, I think that one of the things they're talking about today, you know, Anna and Stella are talking a lot about the fact that we need to be thinking about how technology can be better used to position our people. Quote, a lot of tech is used to make things more efficient, but not make the experience better. A really powerful point as we think about culture and why people come to work. And no doubt I agree with the point by Anna on, we've given a lot of our power, our business, our politics, social economics to technologists. And we're coming to a point of decision. Who are we worshiping in this process? I think now with OpenAI, ChatGPT, no doubt this is becoming a conversation that is not going to go away anytime soon. I want to close by quoting a page from their book. In it, they talk about the need for a manifesto as we tackle and consider the urgency with which we have to lead work forward. In it, here is just a few lines. They say we need to move to people over human capital, work over jobs, workplace over office, worker experience over worker efficiency, impact over productivity, networks over hierarchies, and trust over control. If you haven't already, head on over to your local bookstore, pick up Humans at Work, The Art and Practice of Creating the Hybrid Workplace by Anna Tavis and Stella Lupashore. Now, don't forget to subscribe to Bring It In so you never miss an episode. We've got some awesome guests lined up that you're not going to want to miss. Now, back to work.